There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome back to The Grill. Robbie Greenfield, Mark Archer and Sean O'Shea with you through until 6 p.m. And then we are looking forward to that tasty World Cup match between Argentina and France. Wow, what a fixture for the round of 16. We're building up to that after 5 p.m. We'll keep you across Formula One Austrian Grand Prix qualifying as well. That one gets underway at 5 p.m. There is live tennis to put you in the picture with as well. But we've got some full-time scores in the Super Rugby, Arch.
Yeah, full-time score in Canberra where the Brumbies were taking on the Hurricanes from New Zealand. The Brumbies have scored 19 unanswered points in the second half to defeat the Hurricanes 24-12. Result from earlier today was in Fiji where the Chiefs defeated the Highlanders 45-22. Just switching codes to the NRL Rugby League, and the result just coming in from Suncorp Stadium where the Brisbane Broncos have defeated the Canberra Raiders 26-22.
Live tennis action ongoing. It is the final of Eastbourne between top seed Caroline Wozniacki and Arina Sabalenka. I can tell you that Sabalenka is a break up in the opening set, 3-2, and she's got the serve as well. So Sabalenka a break up in that one as final Wimbledon preparations are completed over at Eastbourne. And that is where we will turn our attention to now, guys. It is Wimbledon. Yes, it's not the World Cup, but it is still one of the greatest sporting events on the calendar, Mark Archer. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's an intriguing one this time around. It's the 10-year anniversary of that incredibly epic final between Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal. What will go down, I think what still is recognised as the greatest tennis match, in many people's opinion, and this is subjective, of course, of all time, that five-setter. You looking forward to Wimbledon this year?
I am, yeah. We've been talking grass with football, but let's talk about the grass of SW19 for a while. Yeah, Wimbledon's a wonderful, iconic calendar sporting event in the Great Britain sort of sporting calendars. You know, your cricket at Lord's and you've got Royal Ascot and you've got the Open Championship coming up at Carnoustie, but it doesn't beat Wimbledon, all strawberries and cream and all that sort of thing. So it is wonderful. The players are in their whites, so much tradition, so much great matches in the past. But the GOAT, Roger Federer, trying to win, what is he, 10th now? Ninth Wimbledon title. Almost unfathomable that he's won that many. He gets better with age, doesn't he? So let's see how he goes. For me, question mark, he's missed the French season, which makes perfect sense when he's trying to keep his body in peak shape. It's just whether he can actually physically survive 2 weeks of a Grand Slam on grass if the matches go into a lot of fifth sets. He's efficient with his economy, with his playing style. If his serve's going well, Robbie, if that big first serve that Roger's got is going well, he can win some quick points, win some quick games, and then win some quick sets and move through. But if he's tested physically in the first week, then you maybe just doubt whether he can survive. But he's just so fine-tuned at getting his game right for the big tournaments now. What chooses what to play, what to miss, when to train, how to diet. He's been doing it for so long. It's tough to see past Roger Federer.
Bold words. Bold words. He is the favourite. It is amazing that Federer and Nadal, 10 years after that famous match, once again will arrive at SW19 as the number one and number two seeds in the men's draw. What of that draw? A little bit more information. Let's put some meat on the bones now. Take a listen to this.
Welcome to the draw for the 132nd Championships. We will start with the gentlemen's singles. First of these, number 104, Benoit Paire. We'll play number 100, Andy Murray. Joe Konta will play number 119, Natalia Viklyantseva. Number 98, Arantxa Rus, will play Serena Williams.
It is quite a coincidence to see Andy Murray and Benoit Paire paired together once again at Wimbledon, because Paire was the last man Murray beat in a Grand Slam in the fourth round on centre court last year. Murray says he will play as long as he feels competitive. Paire is 48 in the world. He's very talented, he's very powerful, but he's also hugely unpredictable. The new British number one is Carl Edmund. He could play Novak Djokovic in the third round, but has to get past the Australian qualifier Alex Bolt first of all. Lots of interest in Serena Williams and where she would land in the draw. She's the 25th seed, so she can't play another seeded player before the third round, but in the third round it could be the fifth seed Alina Svitolina for the seven-time champion. And lots of the British women have got very very tough first round draws. Naomi Brody in particular, she will open the centre court programme on Tuesday afternoon against the defending champion Garbiñe Muguruza.
So some insight into the draw there, and I can tell you as well that Roger Federer, he takes on Dusan Lajovic, while world number one Rafa Nadal, he will take on Dudi Seller of Israel. So, Mark Archer, what of this draw? Andy Murray, has he got any chance to do well this year? I don't think anyone is expecting him to win, but can he go ahead?
So many expectations on Andy Murray playing the event he's won twice, particularly playing at home. He's going to have all the pressure of the English media and the crowd wanting to watch him play. Whether he's got enough games on grass, you know, in his locker now to perform throughout the 2 weeks, and can he go far? I doubt. Whether his body will hold up for 2 weeks, I think he's questioning that himself. He's not yet 100% committed that he's going to play. We'll listen to a bit of audio shortly saying he hasn't quite made his mind up whether he can be competitive to go. So I'm sure he's hitting a lot of balls. He's probably playing some pretty hard practice matches and doing some hard sessions to see if his body is 100%. He's had that debilitating hip injury for almost 12 months now, and he hasn't played a lot of tournament tennis. And when he did come back in the last couple of weeks, well, he's had a differing degree of success, really. So whether he can go a long way in the tournament, look, it'd be great to see him play. But if you're Andy Murray and you're in your 30s, you don't want to re-injure your hip by trying to force yourself to play Wimbledon. And that'll be going in his mind, whether he has some injury doubts or not. So I think everyone would love to see Andy Murray take part and be competitive and go a long way in the tournament. I just don't know if that's going to happen or not.
Well, let's hear from Andy Murray now. He was speaking in the run-up to this tournament on that decision as to whether to play or not.
You know, tennis is unique in the sense that, you know, I've come back from not playing for 11 months and I'm playing against the top 20 players in the world and competing for full matches. You know, in a lot of other sports, especially team sports, you come back and you play 15, 20 minutes and kind of build your fitness up that way. You know, so we don't really have the luxury of doing that in tennis, so you kind of have to put yourself out there in the matches and just sort of see a little bit how you respond. And you know, I won't know until I'm in that position.
You clearly want to be competitive. Is that what the decision hinges on?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, speak to my team. It's not like I'm going to do any damage if I, you know, to myself if I do play at Wimbledon. But it's just whether or not I need sort of. You obviously gain stuff physically by playing matches, and obviously ultimately that's the best test for you is to play competitive matches. You know, but also at this stage in kind of my rehab, the training side of things and getting physically stronger and playing the matches, you also see certain things that need to improve. Like, you know, my serve, and is there things that I need to do in the gym to improve that? You know, my movement in certain positions could get better as well. And, you know, how do you go about improving that? Does that come from being on the match court, being on the practice court, or doing more work in the gym? It's sort of a learning process that me and all my team are going through just now, and that's kind of how we make the decisions, really.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, the only place to view football this summer.
We are looking at building up, to Wimbledon. That one gets underway on Monday at the All England Club, the third Grand Slam in tennis of the year, the third of four, and it is a chance, of course, for Roger Federer to add yet another historical footnote to an extraordinary career. Nine Wimbledon titles is what he's aiming for. He's already won a staggering eight, not quite on the pace of Rafa Nadal over at the Red Clay of Paris, who's won 11 over there, but Roger Federer, nonetheless, is the ultimate king of centre court. Let's hear from him now. He was talking after losing that final in Halle to Borna Coric, an unexpected loss there, and about his build-up to this Wimbledon Championships.
Losing should hurt, and it does a little bit, because I actually thought I played maybe my best match. Just didn't go my way, so it's a bit unfortunate there, you know, but I'm definitely going to leave, you know, with my head high, thinking it's been a good run, Stuttgart and here. And definitely looking forward to some recovery time now next week, and just some easy preparation and all that. And just, you know, really going to love going to Wimbledon, you know, and being the defending champion always creates pressure. So regardless if I would have won or lost here, regardless, I'm going to be one of the favorites there. But all of that stuff doesn't matter. I just really need to make sure I play great tennis from the get-go, and hopefully I can do that there again.
Yeah, it's interesting talking to hear Roger there say that he goes in as the defending champion. Now, of course, last year Andy Murray was the defending champion and Roger Federer didn't have that burden. He'd won in Australia, he'd taken the clay court season off again, he went in, he absolutely steamrolled the field, beat Marin Cilic in a one-sided final in straight sets, Mark Archer. But there is that added pressure of being the defending champion. It's one of those intangibles. We've already talked about it in the World Cup as well, about these early exits from the defending champions at the group stages in so many of the recent World Cups. There's something unseen there that does have an effect, and that might be weighing on his mind.
I agree with you, but when you've won the tournament eight times, you've been a defending champion eight times, you're probably used to dealing with that pressure and the expectation. I think Roger Federer has been around long enough that he knows every time he goes and plays a tennis match, he is favourite to win it. He's favourite to win the majority of tournaments that he enters, bar maybe the French Open. And he deals with that burden, he deals with it better than most. He's cool, calm and collected at the best of times, isn't he, Roger Federer? And he just oozes class. And I think he deals with the expectation and the burden of being the number one seed, arguably the greatest player of all time, and he deals with particularly on the grass of Wimbledon, where his record is phenomenal. And I don't think it's an issue for Roger. I think Andy Murray, on the other hand, being from the UK, or I was going to say English, but he's Scottish, playing at home with the pressure of the media, the extra hype, the extra column inches, particularly in the tabloids, putting it on Andy Murray, it's an extra level, extra layer of sort of pressure to deal with. And so I think for Roger Federer, No doubt. I think he thrives on the. He wants to be number one seed. He wants to be the guy players fear, and he deals with that accordingly.
Let's talk about some of the other contenders for that Wimbledon crown. We got to touch on the number two seed, the French Open champion, the man who has won at SW19 twice before in 2008. It is the 10-year anniversary, of course, as we mentioned, of Rafa Nadal's famous victory over Federer. He backed that up with another win 2 years later, didn't he? Against I think it might have been Söderling in the final. I'm reaching there perhaps a little bit, but we'll double check that one. But he hasn't done well at Wimbledon since 2011, when he reached the final and lost to Novak Djokovic. He's been going out in the early stages, as I think the toll that is taken in that clay court season continues to increase. It becomes that much more difficult for Nadal to be a threat at Wimbledon. He puts so much into the clay court season, invariably that ends in a victory at Roland Garros, and it looks like now at this stage of his career that making that transition from clay to grass, such a difficult test in itself, is too big an ask at his age.
It's weird to say it, but you almost see the necessity that Nadal should almost do what Federer does, and Federer skips the clay court season in France. And you could almost see Nadal skipping the grass season, because to my knowledge, he hasn't played a warm-up tournament on grass in the last 2 weeks since winning the French Open. I don't think he's taken to a tournament on grass to prepare. He's going to go into Wimbledon pretty fresh, and then you expect it's probably a tougher surface from now as he's slightly older and had the injuries. He plays so much competitive tennis on the clay, where he's barely ever loses a match ever, whether he's playing in Rome. In Madrid, in the big lead-up tournaments, the Master Series tournaments, well, then he goes in the French Open, where invariably you play long matches, they take a long period of time, and he plays for a whole 2 weeks, he gets to the final and wins it. It's just, it must take 3 to 4 weeks to get your body back in any sort of normal form. By that time, Wimbledon's almost upon you, underway, you haven't probably done the prep, you probably haven't hit the amount of balls you need to play, you just haven't played competitive matches on grass. So, for me, I think Wimbledon became more of a priority for Nadal probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, when he hadn't won it and hadn't done that well on that surface, and he had to change his game slightly from being the dominant clay court player. So for me, it's great if Nadal plays, but I think there'll be other players who are strongly, even though he's the number two seed, who will be more favourited to sort of go a long way in the tournament ahead of Nadal, for me anyway.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, and I've been corrected. It was, of course, Thomas Berdych who lost to Rafa Nadal in the 2010 Wimbledon final. So there you go, Nadal, a two-time winner there. What about the number three seed? And that is, of course, Alex Zverev. Marin Cilic is the number three seed. We'll get to him in just a moment. What of Alex Zverev, though, Mark Archer, the number four seed? He has struggled at Grand Slams. His best result thus far is a quarterfinal appearance in the French Open, where he was beaten very comfortably by Dominic Thiem, who went all the way on to reach the final there at Roland Garros. He's flattered to deceive a little bit in Grand Slams. Now, the caveat to that is that he is only 21 years of age. And when you think about the ages that these players typically break through, I think Roger Federer was 22, 23 when he won his first Wimbledon title. Pete Sampras, a similar age when he did it back in 1993. So It's a bit harsh to expect too much on the top stage, the top level, from Alex Zverev, who's become such a great player on the ATP Tour. Can he challenge? Can he win a first Grand Slam at Wimbledon?
I think he will win a Grand Slam at Wimbledon in his career, but I think he's maybe still a year too soon for Zverev. He has been a great new addition onto the scene. He's burst on and done really well in quite a short space of time. And it's nice, we've been talking about it for a number of years now. Who is the next generation of superstars? Who is going to replace Nadal? Who's going to replace Federer? Who's the next Andy Murray? Who's going to take Djokovic's place at the top table? So we want to see that young generation, whether it be Dominic Thiem, who's done well on clay. Zverev is the other name we've talked about a lot. I hope he goes a long way in the tournament. He's quite a fun personality. He has plenty of banter in his press conferences. He plays tennis the right sort of way. You know, he seems to be pretty aggressive with his style. So let's hope he goes a long way in the tournament. He will win Wimbledon, I believe, in his career. I just don't think it's this year. He's still a year. He's still 12 months too soon for him.
Marin Cilic, he is the third seed. He is the champion at Queen's Club. He's the finalist from 12 months ago. He's also a semi-finalist at the Australian Open as well. So he's got the pedigree in of late at the Grand Slams. I actually think Marin Cilic is the biggest threat to Roger Federer. I know I'm not exactly overreaching myself there. He is the third seed. Rafa Nadal, the second seed, has a history of struggling at this tournament in the last 5 years. But Marin Cilic has as good a chance, in my opinion, as Roger Federer going into this Wimbledon. Thoughts?
Yeah, the big hitting Croatian. He's been consistent across all surfaces, hasn't he? He's gone a long way in all tournaments on the different formats and surfaces that you play. I like him as a player. I just question his what I'd call big match temperament. If he gets the semi-final, final, we saw him break down in tears against Federer. Was it against Federer or Murray?
It was against Federer. The blisters.
Yeah, he had blisters and it wasn't going in his way and he almost walked off the court knowing that he couldn't kick on past that, and he became very emotional in the big moment. And that always, for me, just in the back of my mind, creates a bit of a nagging doubt. But look, he's incredibly consistent. He's had great results in the last couple of weeks on the build-up tournaments. Was it the Queen's Club?
He beat Djokovic in the final.
Yep, so he's obviously got some form and momentum going to this. You'd expect him to be there sort of quarter-final stage onwards, and he's got the ability to take out one of the big players. For me, I just question his temperament on the final stages, maybe a semi-final or final at Wimbledon.
We'll look a little further down the list of men's seedings, and I'm going to touch on the name of Novak Djokovic, a three-time winner at Wimbledon. A tough first-round match for Djokovic. Tennis Sangren, the American player who had a good run down in Australia, didn't he? So he's not going to be an easy first-round opponent whatsoever. But Djokovic, seeded 12th, will have a tougher route through the draw than he's used to at Wimbledon. He did make the final at Queen's. He has shown signs, flickers, of getting back to his old self, but there is that mental question mark over Djokovic, a player when he was in his pomp who would just base so much of his game around an absolute willpower to win at all costs, even to the point where in famously he would even batter Rafa Nadal, that great competitor, into submission in some of those long finals like that one down in Australia in 2012. What of his chances? Is he too frail mentally at this stage in time? Is his game not quite there? Or are we perhaps underestimating Novak Djokovic? And given the fact he's a three-time winner, could he go ahead and go all the way?
I think first and foremost, good to see him back playing tennis at the competitive level. Obviously making the final at Queen's last week will give him a massive boost for his ego and his sort of confidence. He's had well-documented injury problems. I think he's had the wrist that's just kept him out off the court for a long time. He's had some pretty well-documented issues off the court in his personal life that he's had to deal with. He doesn't seem to be mentally the same player he was when he was so dominant. 3 or 4 years ago, he was the argument that I'll put forward is he was more as dominant a player as Federer in his pomp and Nadal in his pomp as Djokovic was when he was world number one.
Absolutely.
I think he went a season with...
Well, he won all four in a row. No one's ever done that.
Four in a row, and I think he lost five or six matches in a season, max, which was unparalleled. And I don't think we're going to see him reach the heights due to the injury issues, due to maybe not being as quite young and in his peak as he was. But it'll be interesting to see how he goes. Being that lower seed, he's going to get tough matches early in the tournament. I think we listened to that audio piece earlier where he said in the third round he could take on Kyle Edmund, the Englishman, who's been a form player in world tennis, who's done well in recent months. Edmund will have the crowds behind him. He'll have Henman Hill cheering for him. He'll be the great hope of the Brits for that match. So for me, Djokovic, again, on his day, can take out pretty much any of those players. you know, on his day. So let's wait and see. If he goes into the second week of the tournament and finds some momentum, then he's a tough guy to get past.
Certainly is. That is the men's side of the draw. What of the women's side of the draw? We'll talk that. We'll talk a little cricket when we come back as well. And don't forget, from 5 o'clock, that the attention returns to the football. We're building up. We've had a message in. It's like two semi-finals on round of 16 day. I could not agree more. Hugely excited about this evening's matches. France-Argentina, Portugal-Uruguay, much more build-up and lots more sport as well when we come back.
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, the only place to view football this summer.
Yeah, welcome back. It has just gone 4:30, 25 to 5 on your Saturday afternoon. We're with you all the way through until 6 p.m. It's myself, Robbie, it's Mark Archer, it's Sean O'Shea, taking a little breather from all things non-football as we look ahead to the Wimbledon Championships. It's one of my favourite events of the year. It gets underway at the All England Club, SW19, from Monday. Lots of talking points in the build-up to this tournament. Roger Federer, of course, going for a ninth Wimbledon title. Novak Djokovic coming in as that number 12 seed. Rafa Nadal, the second seed in that draw. And Andy Murray still yet to confirm for absolute certain whether he will take place and take part in Wimbledon, a tournament that he has won two times before. What of the women's draw? I can tell you the live action over at Eastbourne in the final there. Aryna Sabalenka taking on top seed Caroline Wozniacki. Wozniacki was a breakdown early in that first set. She has got that break back. She is 6-5 up. It is on serve. Sabalenka serving to force a tiebreak in that first set. We'll keep you updated as to that match. But what of the seedings at the Wimbledon draw, Mark Archer, for the women at least? We've got Simona Halep, the French Open champion, finally breaking her duck, her Grand Slam duck over there in Paris, arriving at SW19, full of confidence, I'm sure, and in fine form. But as a Wimbledon champion, do you look to other people? Do you look to Garbiñe Muguruza, the defending champion who was so fantastic 12 months ago? What about all the way down on that list, the 25th seed, Serena Williams? We'll have a discussion as to whether she should have been seeded or not in just a moment. Who do you like in this draw? It's a wide open tournament, as it always seems to be in the women's game. But who's standing out for you before a ball is struck at SW19?
Look, I was very happy when Simona Halep won the French Open. I think she'd been there or thereabouts for long enough, knocking on the door, and she's been an incredibly consistent performer, albeit she couldn't quite get a slam under her belt. I think she'll go from strength to strength, and she's got sort of enough of an all-court game to justify that number one seed and to go a long way in the tournament. And she would have taken some time off after her victory in the French Open. I think she'll be one of the players to beat there. Caroline Wozniacki's in great form. Obviously, she's just playing the final at Eastbourne as we speak. She'll be there or thereabouts, you would have hoped. And then you talk about the other players who think can do well. Petra Kvitova is always one that you always want to keep an eye on at Wimbledon. It seems to suit the surface, suits her style, her power game, her big serve. The left-hander, of course, causes issues for Petra Kvitova. You see her being in the mix as well. And then it's tough to go past the 25th seed, and we can debate over whether she should have been seeded, shouldn't have been seeded. But Serena Williams, it's just the one play you just don't want to play. It doesn't matter who you are. In that, particularly early on when she's still got, you know, she's still fresh and fit. Whether Serena Williams has the match fitness to go 2 weeks and be there at the end, I question it. She's coming off, a pectoral injury that meant she had to pull out of the French Open when she was had that mouth-watering clash against Maria Sharapova. That didn't take place. But Serena, and this is the dilemma when you seed her or don't seed her, she's going to come against some of the good players really early in the tournament. And when she's fit and fresh, you can't count her out. She's got to go into those matches favourites, given her past record. So
Yeah. That's
the dilemma with the seeding of Serena. For me, look, she went off and had the child. That's great. That's her right. For me, you look at her past record.
Nice of you to allow that.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, the right to go off and have a child. So for me, though, I think her seeding actually should be higher. I think if you're going to seed her, then you see her higher. If you don't see it, then you don't see it. But you can't. 25th is neither no man's land. It's going to cause havoc with the draw. If she goes three or four rounds, she's going to knock out a couple of the top 10 seeds doing that. And that's going to be really interesting.
If you were on the Wimbledon committee, where would you have seeded her, or not at all?
I'd put her in the top 10, probably around fifth or sixth.
Okay.
That's my, without looking at it too scientifically and not giving a lot of justification for that, I think her former record, if she's fit and if she's playing and if she's in the draw, she's got to be maybe around fifth or sixth.
It's a big if, though, isn't it? I mean, she's pulled out with a pectoral injury, as you mentioned, against Maria Sharapova at the French Open. She's not played hardly any tennis since coming back. She played at the exhibition against Ostapenko in Abu Dhabi back in December. Then she took another bunch of time off. Then she came back. She played one or two tournaments in the US. They were curtailed because she lost early. She started to get the swing back into it. She started to get back into that competitive flow. But has she really played enough tennis to justify a high seeding at Wimbledon? I mean, yeah, if you're trading on record, then put her as top seed. But for me, if I were on the committee, I wouldn't seed her.
You wouldn't seed her? So I'll ask you a similar question and see what you say. If Roger Federer hadn't played much tennis in the last 9 months and he was coming back, do you seed Roger or not seed him? And say his world ranking's the same as Serena. I think she's in the 60 or
70.
183rd. If Roger Federer took time off tennis with 183rd, yet came back into Wimbledon, would you not give him a seed?
If Roger Federer had had exactly the same results as Serena Williams and taken a year off tennis, no.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't. Because all you're doing is seeding based on...
form.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not the number one. He's the number two in the world. They seed him number one, so they're not taking that. They're taking that on form. As opposed to...
You can tweak it. You can tweak the seedings. You can tweak... You've got a license to... For example, if Nadal is number one and Federer is number two, but Federer's got the grass court record to go with it, then I totally support that. But you've got to take everything into account, Arch. And the fact that she just hasn't played enough tennis in the last 3 or 4 months has to be a factor here.
Question, I'm asking this because I don't know the answer. Is Andy Murray seeded? Did they give him a seed? They must have done. Because his world ranking must be in the teens somewhere at the moment. And it's a similar argument to Andy Murray. So if he plays, he must be seeded, I would have thought, but down the seedings.
Andy Murray is not seeded.
He's not seeded, okay.
No.
That's interesting.
Andy Murray is not seeded. As far as I can see.
Yeah, I mean, I can see your argument. I think you can mount a successful argument for or against the seeding of Serena Williams. But for me, her track record dictates that if she's in the field and if she starts and if she turns up on Monday ready to play, she should be given a top 10 seeding, not 25th.
Okay. All right, we will agree to disagree on that one. Let us know your thoughts. Should Serena Williams have been seeded? 4001. We'll move the conversation on to cricket, Arch. It's been a while since we touched on cricket, and I know that quite a lot has happened in that space of time. We've seen an ODI series take place between England and Australia. I think that was England's first ever whitewash of Australia in an ODI series. 5-0 on home soil, of course. Very different and nice to get a modicum of revenge for what happened in the Ashes. But from your point of view, was that down to Australia in their current predicament and their struggles, or was that the fact that England just played exceptionally well?
I think there's two things. I think England are an incredibly good and consistent one-day side at the moment. They've got some explosive players with the batting. They're playing at home. Australia, well, they've had a pretty hard couple of months. They're missing David Warner, Stephen Smith through the bans, and they're also missing some of their bowling lineup. Mitchell Stark wasn't there. Josh Hazlewood wasn't there. So they were a depleted side, I think it's very fair to say. Even though the result was overwhelmingly in the favour of the English, 5-0 in the ODI series, Australia probably should have won the last one, albeit for amazing innings by Joss Butler, who got them across the line. Then they won the T20 International. They just got momentum. And one of their big power hitters got them out of trouble all the time. And you look at their batting lineup: Alex Hales, Jason Roy, Johnny Bairstow, Ben Stokes wasn't even in the team, Joss Butler, Owen Morgan. They got power all the way down the order. When you got Moen Ali coming in 8 or 9, as you're sort of in that sense, you're in an embarrassment of riches. So England did what they had to do. They won the match at home. Australia, they'll learn a little bit about it. I think they probably underperformed, but they would have exposed a lot of young players to one-day international cricket, and that can only be a good thing. But England, yeah, maybe peaking a year too early from the World Cup.
Well, it's been a tough start to the captaincy of Tim Payne, taking it over in less than perfect surroundings and circumstances from Steve Smith. More on Steve Smith in just a moment. But here, well, the Aussie captain admits that the pressure got to him.
It wasn't as difficult as Trent Bridge, but yeah, we've certainly been taught a lesson from a world-class outfit.
What did you think for 114 for 8? Could you have done anything different in that last period?
Yeah, we could have got a couple more wickets, would have been nice, but I thought we had them under pressure and Rashid and Joss played obviously really well, but I just didn't think we got enough balls in the right area at those two in particular, and they batted well, and when we've been under pressure in this series, we haven't responded as well as we would like, so that's a lesson we've got to learn.
Because you did get it reversing, do you feel you went just a little bit full towards the end there? You could have helped your length back a little bit?
Yeah, perhaps a little bit, but I thought mainly to Rashid and Joss, we probably bowled a touch wide for the start of their partnership, and we saw early when Billy hit the stumps a lot more that we created chances. So, again, they played outstandingly well.
And earlier in the day, 205, at the end there, we were thinking, crikey, if we just got 20 or 30 more, or did you think that that was okay for that surface?
No, I thought we were in trouble, to be honest, at the halfway mark. But as I said, I thought our bowlers came out and committed to what we spoke about really well in that first sort of an hour that we're out there, and we created enough chances. But as I said time and time again this series, once we've been put under pressure, whether it be bat, ball or in the field, we've folded a little bit, if we're completely honest.
You said you wanted to find out about players in this series. Do you think you found out plenty?
Yeah, I think we have. Even today we saw Alex Carey and Darcy Shorter, two really good young players, played really well after, again, our senior players probably let us down. And, I think we've seen Billy Stanlake, Ashton Agar. There's some real talent in this group. And as I've said previously, this tour, if we can get our best team on the park with some of these talented youngsters, anything's possible.
And you personally, you've been given a bit of a hospital pass, missing a lot of senior players, change of culture, wicketkeeper, batsman. Have you been able to enjoy it at all, or has it been really difficult?
It's been difficult, but it's sort of goes with the job, doesn't it? I've come back into Test cricket. I tried to enjoy that as much as I could, and if I'm honest, I probably let the pressure of this series get to me a little bit. And clearly, when you're not performing, things aren't as fun at the international level. So that's how it goes sometimes.
We've seen with individual sportsmen, Arch, like Tiger Woods and Novak Djokovic, then when something has happened that has embarrassed them, it has taken away their bulletproof self-confidence on the pitch. Is that similar to what might have gone on now with the Australian team? This has been such an embarrassment to them that they've almost been their kind of self-destruct, or I'm trying to put my phrase in here. Do you see what I'm getting at here?
You know,
the cloak of invincibility.
Yeah, to a degree. Look, I think the Australian team have wanted to make since the ball tampering incident in South Africa and the subsequent bans of the captain, Steve Smith, and David Warner and Cameron Bancroft, and the resignation or firing of Darren Lehman, however you want to put it, they have made and Justin Lang has come in as the new coach, Tim Payne's there stepping in as captain. They've made a philosophical change of how they want to play the game. They want to play hard, but they think that, the thing is they want to play a little bit fairer. They don't want to be verbal bullies that they've been accused of being in the past. They don't want to have the gamesmanship that they've occasionally, the over-aggressiveness that they've been accused of the past. They want to try and tone it down a little, yet keep that sort of compelling streak of aggression. There's a fine line between being, in that grey area.
But is it not so rooted in their culture?
Well, it is indeed. And if you ever play school cricket in Australia, you play grade cricket over there, it's sort of Australian sports sort of comes from. It's a cultural ethos. So it's very hard to then make a rapid 360-degree change and try and be something that you're maybe not naturally ingrained to do. And maybe that's where they're getting caught between the two systems. Look, they've got some young players in the team not affected by the ball tampering incident. They'll just crack on with it. And let's wait and see. Look, let's give it some time. This is the first series Australia played since that thing. And I think you've got to give them a bit more of a bigger sample size of matches, home and away, to see how they deal. What will be interesting is see when Australia play back home next, because they haven't played cricket at home since the incident in South Africa. How does the crowd respond to them? How do they sort of support them in that? So let's wait and see. Let's hold the jury out on that aura that the Australian cricket team did have
maybe
for such a long time.
Yeah, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here. We will, though, talk about a certain two individuals that were at the centre of that ball tampering scandal. Why? Because they are back in action, of all places, Canada. More on that next.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, bringing the football stadium to you this summer.
Yes, Farah the Falcon. It's fair to say she had a mixed performance in the group stages. Her ascent to celebrity status among the animal predicting community, Mark Archer, has not been a smooth one. But now it's make or break time.
Well, it's go hard or go home for Farah now. It's
well,
all
there's
down.
No draws, right?
Exactly.
Even if these matches are drawn, they will eventually end in penalty
exactly.
shootouts.
Exactly. I heard she was being intimidated by the Nigerian community regarding some of her predictions, and maybe that just put off her game slightly.
Well, we've uploaded all 48 of her group stage predictions and all the round of 16 predictions, by the way, if you do want to check them out, on our YouTube channel. Dubai Eye 103.8 Sports.
Who has Farah elected to back today?
Well, I don't want to give that away, just in case people want to actually, you know, go and look and watch our YouTube channel. Okay. We need the hits, Mark Archer. I'm not just going to give this free information away.
How does one go about finding out? So it's YouTube, Farah the Falcon, hashtag?
No, YouTube, Dubai Eye Sports, Twitter, of course, Instagram as well, Dubai Eye Sport. And, There are no draws now, so therefore. But I did run an odds predictor on getting all eight of the predictions right of this round of 16, and the odds are about 40-1. So they're very much stacked against our Farah the Falcon. Let's see though if she does have a good record. I think Paul the Octopus was 10 out of 12, but he cheated a little. He selected his games, and I don't know. Farah has been probably almost too diligent. She's worked too hard. She's done every single game of this World Cup. And
obviously feeling the pressure now.
Feeling the pressure, for sure. A bit like Tim Payne, the Australian cricket captain. The pressure is getting to her. We'll return to the cricket before we return to the football, because we will be building up to Argentina versus France from 5 o'clock. But I want to talk briefly, if we can, about Steve Smith and David Warner. And I want to hear from them as well, because they have re-emerged after that time away spent in hiding, being reclusive and keeping away from the bright lights after the following of their one-year ban for the ball tampering scandal. Steve Smith's role in it, David Warner's role in it, and of course Cameron Bancroft as well, who was banned for 9 months for being the man that carried out the plan on the field. But what of it now? Steve Smith is back in action. He's playing over in Canada, and he's been talking and reflecting on the last 6 or 7 months. And I think given having the time to take a step back from it all has given him a little bit more clarity. Take a listen.
I've been up and down with my emotions. If I'm being honest, it's, you know, I've had times, particularly, you know, watching the boys play in England and not play as well as they could have, and England play extremely well. It was, you know, hurting me that I couldn't go out and help them and help them win games. And when they hopped on the plane over there, I had some emotions that were a bit down. But, you know, it's been tough. But, you know, I think I needed a break, if that makes sense. You know, it's obviously come under some ordinary circumstances, but I was really mentally fatigued after the Ashes. I put so much into the Ashes that, you know, I even think back to the one-day games after the Ashes. I don't think I've ever hit the ball that bad in my life. I was making horrible decisions, and I just felt horrible at the crease. And, you know, I think it all just comes down to the mental sort of part of the game, and just putting so much into that Ashes back home that it just took just so much out of me. So, you know, a bit of a break perhaps isn't the worst thing. Hopefully I'll be able to come back and perform at a really high level again, but we'll see what happens.
Sounded like he was giving that interview at a bus stop, Mark Archer, and not a press conference centre. Steve Smith speaking there. I read a fascinating article. I would recommend any of you who love your cricket to check this out. It's on The Age. I think part of the Sydney Morning... Is that the Sydney Morning Herald supplement? It might be. I think it's the same style, but it was a long-form piece simply titled What Turned Steve Smith Into a Cheat? Because when Steve Smith was coming up through the ranks, he was known as a very honest, very fair, a guy that played tough but fair. A talented player, obviously, in the junior ranks, and someone who was earmarked for greatness from a long time out. But this article details how the system almost breaks you down to the point where you're in the heat of battle and you start making decisions that perhaps you never would have made in your younger days, or the way you were raised to believe and the way you were brought up to behave. And the pressure placed on these cricketers by not just the Cricket Australia, but every nation's, every top-level elite nation's cricketing board, where performance and success is so intrinsically linked to sponsorship and revenue, isn't it? These guys get a lot of criticism if they lose. They get a lot of adulation if they win. And they're cosseted. They're in a bubble arch, aren't they? They are away. That there was talk, and it's a fascinating piece. It talks about how Steve Smith had nothing else in his life other than cricket, where cricket became the be-all and end-all. He had no wider interests. He had nothing to divert his attention from the job of winning test matches. And in that environment, in that bubble, it is easy, perhaps. You can have sympathy with desperation setting in, knowing that you need a win, and that test was slipping away from them, wasn't it, in Cape Town. You can, I'm not justifying it, I'm not condoning it, but you can see how it could happen to a player under those circumstances.
Yeah, particularly an Australian cricket captain, they often say that the job is of the Australian captain in particular is the most important, prominent position in Australian society, albeit more important than the Prime Minister. So they're under a lot of spotlight. It's the national sport of a sports-crazy country, and you're in the heat of the battle every time. You take the field, and on and off the field, you're a high-class, high-profile celebrity and sportsman. So he just had to deal with that, and maybe he was all consumed by the role as captain. Nice to see him back playing cricket, which is nice. So his ban, when he was banned by Cricket Australia, meant that he couldn't play national team cricket for Australia. He couldn't play first class cricket for New South Wales, where he plays. He is allowed to play club cricket, and he is allowed to play in some of these other T20 leagues around the world. So he's playing in the inaugural Global T20 Canadian League, of all places, and he's also playing there for the Toronto Nationals. And just for the record, Toronto beat Vancouver Knights by 6 wickets in that match, and he did score 61 of 41 balls. So he found some sort of form in his first competitive appearance since that ball tampering banning back in March.
Well, David Warner is also there playing for the brilliantly named Winnipeg Hawks over in Canada. He's been talking about how his life has changed post that ball tampering scandal. We can hear from him now.
Yes, it definitely has been. Not just for me, but for my family. Obviously, the fans out there that support cricket and Australian cricket. So, you know, I'm responsible for that. You know, that's my fault. You know, and it's why I've had some tough times. But, you know, I'm an adult. I'm big, strong. And, you know, I'll move forward and keep continuing to move forward and making sure I'm doing the right things at the right time to keep playing the best cricket I can. Me and Steve, we're good mates, you know. If people hang in the hotel, they'll see us, you know, hanging out with each other and stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, it was a big thing that happened. And for us, you've got to handle it in your individual way and then how you handle it collectively. And we haven't really been able to catch up because he's been away. You know, Cameron's been in Perth and I've been doing what I'm doing. And I've got, you know, family at home. So it's been hard, but this has been good. We've caught up. We've had numerous chats and I'm sure we'll hang out plenty more. We're in the same hotel. You know, being at home for the last 12 weeks was great for me. It was great for my mind. You know, there's a lot of mental scars after the Ashes. That probably saw my form and maybe Steve as well in that one-day series against England. You know, it takes a lot out of you. And, you know, moving on to South Africa and then what happened, you know, it was really, really tough. And, you know, we're responsible for that and we're moving on. But to get back out here and play cricket, it's really good for us mentally. I was excited about the opportunity and chance to actually come here and play and to do what we love. You know, you can't sit at home and dwell on what's happened in the past. You've got to move forward. And I felt that this was a great opportunity to get back out there and just play cricket and be happy. Well, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. And, you know, if I look back and look at the past that's happened and the sanctions that have been handed down by the ICC, it is what it is, you know. And for us to come out here and play the game that we love, we're very fortunate for that, and we're grateful for that opportunity that Canada Cricket have given this opportunity. And critics will be critics, you know. That's at the end of the day, that's why they're behind the keyboards. They do what they do, and we just move forward and just try and ignore that.
A little bit of a subtle dig there, I think, at the end from David Warner on those critics. But sport loves a rehabilitation story, doesn't it, Arch? As much as everyone gets up on their high horse to condemn these people when they commit something like they did with the ball tampering scandal, there's nothing better in a way than a player or an individual or a team coming back from a tough moment, a bad decision, dare I say it, a scandal, and actually finding a rehabilitation. Look at the way the golf world is pulling for Tiger Woods right now. Look at Tom Brady coming back from Deflategate. It happens all over the world, all over the sort of sporting map. Will there be the same sentiment, do you feel, for these individuals, or did they so insult the national consciousness of Australia? Because I was interested to see Steve Smith posting on his social media account, I think it was his Instagram account, for the first time in months, and I looked at some of the comments and it was just cheat, 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 all the way down. Now, obviously, it's still raw for people. There are always going to be those keyboard warriors out there. But in a couple of months' time, when the dust has further settled, when these guys look to come back from their ban next year, do you feel like the mood will be behind them? Will there be a sense that people want them to succeed?
I think people's memories are pretty short in sport, and you're only as good as what you do next in performance. So I think for Steve Smith, he'll find a way to get back into the Australian team. Whether he becomes the captain again, I have my doubts. Whether they want to keep him up there, but he might be better just coming back and being integrated as a player. I still question whether David Warner, given the new culture that they've adopted or they've verbalised that Justin Lang has said as coach, this is the way he wants to play the game, this is the style of the way they're going to play it, this is going to be the philosophy of the team. I'm not sure if David Warner fits that philosophy unless he is an incredibly reformed character. As talented he is with the bat and as a cricketer in all three formats, whether it be T20, ODIs or Test cricket, I just don't know if that new culture of that Australian cricket team will accept David Warner back. But then again, he's then free to go off and play all these T20 leagues, a bit like Chris Gayle do, and probably do incredibly well as his career. Because you can't deny a man his career, and he's a professional cricketer. Whether he has that success with Australia again will be interesting to see. But we love a good rehab story, don't we?
We certainly do. It will be interesting to follow that one. It will be interesting to follow the progress of both Warner and Smith as they continue their rehabilitation and their reintegration into the world of cricket. But when we come back, the focus returns once more to the FIFA World Cup. We are now just an hour away, less than the start of the first round of 16 game. France versus Argentina. What a massive game that is. Formula One qualifying over in Austria is underway as well. More on that when we come back.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.